Welcome to Success Genius, the only podcast for ambitious entrepreneurs who are serious about transforming their productivity game. I'm your host, Master Certified Life Coach and Yogi, Neil Williams, and I believe that true productivity doesn't come from more hours in the office, but from the mindsets and habits that leverage your maximal focus and energy. On this podcast, we'll dive deep into next-level habits, mindset shifts, and unique practices like yoga nidra. But we're steering clear of any band-aid solutions and time-wasting fads. You won't hear me talk about quick fixes, hacks, and trendy apps that promise the world and deliver nothing. Let's be real. How many planners and time management systems have you bought that are either collecting digital or literal dust? You and I both know these don't work. This show is all about the simple, everyday, high-impact practices validated by neuroscience and psychology, because as it turns out, your body is as pivotal to your productivity as your mind. So if you want to get 40 hours of work done in 10, stick around. We've got a lot to talk about. Welcome to the Success Genius Podcast. Okay, in today's episode, I am so very excited to welcome my special guest, Toby Jenkins. He is an amazing entrepreneur, former Olympian, and he is going to dive into a special type of psychology called flexible psychology. And we're going to run through an exercise that I think everyone could benefit from. He took me through this exercise. It was wildly helpful for me. And the whole idea is to give you another tool for your tool belt to help you handle and overcome and navigate the challenges that you are going to experience or are currently experiencing in business and in life. Please welcome my special guest, Toby Jenkins. Toby, welcome to the show. I'm so very excited to have you here with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Neil. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, me too. So you and I were introduced through a mutual client of ours who we both adore. Yes. And so you're new to the podcast. So I would love if we started out with you just telling everybody who you are and kind of what you do.
Sure. So to wind it back a few decades, I've always been somewhat interested in, I'd say, philosophy and self-development. I've always been interested in performance. And first chapter, if I think about these things professionally, was really my Olympic chapter. So I played water polo from year 9 at high school, or year 8 in high school, and then played all the way through to Athens Olympics, played 2 world championships in 2001, 2003. Actually, there was one after as well, 2005. And so the inevitable ups and downs of an Olympic journey. I missed out on Sydney in 2000, which was the Australian hometown Olympics, which was disappointing, but was in the squad then and then decided I'd continue on. And very much it was, if I reflect on that part of my journey, it was about how good could I be? And obviously, it's a contribution to a team, for those who don't know water polo, but it's a team sport. But very much, and I think this is something that often gets overlooked in an athlete, even a team sport journey, is that 90% of your training, whilst you're training with people, is about developing your own capacity to perform, whether that's strategy, technique, strength, conditioning, whatever. And then the contribution, obviously, into the team as the layer that can really differentiate in the situation where the individuals are at the same. And so I loved that journey. And then when I came back from Athens, interestingly, I'd always thought about business and always wanted to start my own business, and figured it was I sat down with a couple of mates and we said, oh, well, it must be a skill like any other. Let's go find out how to do it. Yeah. And so we had the option of kind of jobs. We could go and study business or we could have a crack. And a couple of weeks later, we managed to get some government, a very small government funding, and we managed to help a client part ways with a 200 and check at the time. And that was a big kickoff.
Yeah. So awesome. Yeah.
It was awesome. And the entrepreneurial journey, as Neil, is pretty exhilarating. And Interestingly, when I came back from the Olympics, I was wondering what on earth was going to fill the void of, well, what would fill this passion for water polo? I really didn't see that anything would. And then when I started this business, I realized, wow, this is my new thing. I did play in other world championships, but very much I'd already started to switch focus into business, and I was way more interested in that than I was continuing the pursuit of being an athlete. Then after, wow, it was 2013, again, entrepreneurial journey, ups and downs. We wrote a book. We started Latency. That changed into a coaching business and an education business, cash flow tight, cash flow working, all of that experience, which was highs and lows. And then basically came to this point where in 2013, we ended up moving all of our team to be a more distributed model. So offshoring various processes, using contractors everywhere. We hit a cash flow hole and just couldn't support a full-time team in an office anymore. And that, I didn't realize it at the time, but left a bit of a hole in my world, because I now realize, looking back, that really for me, the bit that excited me the most was how good could this team be? And without having that sort of daily real human connection to each other, I really missed that. And so I wandered around with my business partner, who was and still is a fantastic human. We tried to find me a home in my own company, and I kept sort of wandering around a bit in the dark aimlessly, but still trying to do my piece. And then hit a period in 2016 that I have come to call my crucible, which was I had my second daughter, and she wasn't sleeping. She had silent reflux. I'd had a shoulder operation from throwing a ball for 20 years as hard as I could. And so I wasn't sleeping either. I'd spent 12 weeks on the couch. My father-in-law was in hospital with leukemia at the time. My dad had died from a brain tumor 6 months earlier as well. And what's interesting is it's not so much about the pity, but what happens with pressure is the cracks show up. Mm. And for me, that was very much work. So one of the tools I use now with my clients as an executive coach is, how do you take a quick assessment of what's going on and identify and bring clarity to where the problem lies, as opposed to, and so it's the very same tool that opened my eyes that work was 9 out of 10 in importance for me and 2 out of 10 in satisfaction. All the rest of it was explainable and understandable, and I was working through the grief and all the other bits and pieces, but that was the piece that completely took me by surprise. So I resigned from that company. I started a new company at the time. And this was when I was introduced to the science of psychological flexibility. Mm-hmm. And through that, and in part to help me through this period, because I was feeling very lost. And in that, I drank the Kool-Aid, read all the books, loved it, realized it was a powerful tool for me, and a bunch of questions that we might touch on that I couldn't believe I hadn't asked myself or hadn't documented the answers to. And so I got so excited by this sort of evidence base. And what's interesting around psychological flexibility is it's 40 years of hard psychological science. It's been validated. It started in 1982 with Dr. Stephen Hayes. It's since been validated by World Health Organization in clinical trials in 2021. And so this enormous evidence base has a suite of tools that people can access very quickly. And that's become the core of what I do now as a coach, which is, how can I help others and other teams be the best they can be? But particularly the way I tend to think about it at the moment is, it's about helping top performers who are facing these major shifts or major crucibles or changes in their lives or in their organizations. And how can I help them reinvent what comes next? And often, when I reflect on my journey as an athlete, when I reflect on my journey through that period of my dad dying, I think I just didn't know what was next. And I think that's the challenge that I love solving now with clients, is when you don't know what's next, but you need to make a substantial shift. That's the kind of work that I love doing one-on-one. And so, yeah, I feel very fortunate that every day I get to take this evidence base of psychological flexibility, apply frameworks like Agile and Scrum and some of these others that some of your audience may have heard of as well about. And the primary reason for using those is, it's about operating into uncertainty. You run experiments now with a sense of direction, but perhaps not a clear direction. At the time when I was going through it, I couldn't even set a goal that I cared about, that I wanted to stick to. I just had no idea. And for someone who was so used to setting goals, chasing them, all that kind of stuff, it was a massive shift for me. And if I think about it, you know, the Olympian mindset, and this is what I talk about a lot with clients and in workshops and that sort of stuff, is that as an Olympian, I was taught it was all about harder, tougher, stronger, set goals, chase them, eliminate stress and pressure, and just get after it. And I felt like that was my mode of operating. And yet the evidence suggests that at best, that's maybe a third of the strategies, and that we need to develop these three pillars of open up, be present, and do what matters. And we'll touch on these as we go through, no doubt. But it's a bit like sitting on a one-legged stool and wondering why it gets wobbly as the pressure mounts.
And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on, is because I think flexible psychology is something that I think can be so powerful for entrepreneurs, because I see this in my community. And in fact, inside of one of my programs, we have a Slack channel, and multiple people actually were asking the other day, I want to make a shift in my business, but I don't know how to do that. I don't know what the pivot is. And so I think there's a lot of, amongst entrepreneurs, like maybe you have something that works or has worked, and then you're like wanting to shift and you don't have evidence for that new thing. So I think just in that realm, or in any other way of like obstacles or uncertainty that we tackle in the entrepreneurial world, I just feel like this is such a powerful tool. Like you're saying, it's multiple tools, but I think it's a really powerful way to approach those things. We're going to talk about this exercise in a minute, but you took me through this a couple months ago, and it really did help me kind of frame what I was thinking about and the shift in the direction that I want to take my own business. So I'm so grateful to you that you're going to share that with everybody on the podcast today. And I mean, first of all, you've had such an interesting journey. Like, for the fact that you're an Olympian, and then you've had multiple successful businesses, and now you have another business with also successful, but they all look very different, right? It's not like they're all the same. They're different types of businesses. And I love that you brought up that the science of flexible psychology has been validated, because it's really important to me to provide science-based tools and philosophies and concepts on this podcast, things that we know actually work. It's really, really important. So could we dive in for just a second? Because I think this will be a brand new idea or new concept for my audience. In a nutshell, what is the best way to describe flexible psychology?
So the simplest way is our ability to shift attention.
Oh,
okay. And if I think about what we're trying to do with developing psychological flexibility, again, the old school was harder, tougher, stronger, let's build brick walls and never break. But the reality is that if you hit a brick wall hard enough with a sledgehammer, it cracks. Doesn't matter how good your brick wall is, the bigger the sledgehammer, sooner or later it cracks.
Yeah.
The idea of psychological flexibility is to shift from trying to build brick walls to building trampolines. So then we don't try to stop the sledgehammer, we absorb it and bounce back, absorb, bounce back, absorb, bounce back, absorb, bounce back. And in developing the various aspects of it, and it really is a suite of only a handful of practices, but like anything, it's the reps of those practices that matter.
Yes.
And so the ongoing development, and it's about shifting our attention from our lived experience or what's going on outside of us back to, and one of the things I've learned, sorry, Neil, I'm jumping around a bit, but we have tens of thousands of cognitions in a day. So by that, I mean memories, images, thoughts, feelings, sensations, whatever it might be. We have tens of thousands of those in a day. What we are not trying to do, and what we've learned, is that we cannot control our reaction. And rather than trying to control our reaction, the invitation of psychological flexibility is to choose our response. So if we can't control our reaction, if we can't control what is going on in the world around us, there is so little, in fact, that we control. And so if we can let go of the control mechanisms and recognize in the moment that we still have a choice of how we want to respond, who we want to be, how do I move towards fulfilling a sense of purpose, to fulfilling the goals that really matter to me, to being the person I want to be, because ultimately we all have a finite amount of time, and therefore, regardless of what the goals, regardless of what purpose might feel like, the only opportunity then is, how do I want to act in this moment? Because I might not get the next one. And certainly there's no certainty around a month, 2 months, 3 months, a year. And this has been very real for you, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And so what I love, it's very much about mindfulness. It's about opening up to the fact that we all experience this stuff. I mean, I shared with you, I think last time, that imposter syndrome is my oldest friend. shows up in all sorts of different ways, whether it's just before I get on this podcast, but it's been with me when I reflect, as I always felt like I was the last person selected on teams. I always have wondered, why should I be the person getting up to speak in at a workshop? And I still do. Doesn't matter how many times I've done it. This podcast coming up, it's just a part of who I am. And rather than trying to fight it, it's recognizing that it's showing up and then learning to work with it. And one of the key distinctions I talk about is, rather than trying to be confident, we want to be competent in working with our tough internal experiences, which we all share. Mm-hmm. It's the one certainty that we all have suffering. It's the one thing that we share as humans. And how can we become competent in working with our own brand of suffering and still recognize that we have a choice here, as opposed to being driven by imposter syndrome and not showing up to this podcast interview, right?
Yeah.
So that's how I tend to think about it. So we experience this stuff. Psychological flexibility allows us to shift our focus back to what truly matters. Or what choice do I want to make today and right now in how I show up or how I respond or who do I want to be? And that's the invitation, I think, of psychological flexibility. And the beauty of it is that we can practice it in nearly every moment of every day, pretty much. So there are lots of opportunities to practice as far as I'm concerned.
As we are in the human experience, I 100% agree with you. Like, moment to moment, that can look very different, right? So yeah. A couple things there that you said that I just want to highlight for everybody who's listening, because I think it's really powerful and is worthwhile in bringing up. So you said, the analogy that you created here, in my mind, it was like, oh, I get it. Super powerful. Well, I'm not trying to like be the brick wall. I'm trying to be the trampoline, so that when life hits me with something, I'm not going to crumble. I'm going to absorb that impact and I'm going to bounce back. So I think that bears kind of just repeating. And then also the other thing that you said that I thought was really powerful was, it's the idea of working with, like, understanding yourself, understanding what your things are, which we talked about in my call with you, like mine's anxiety, right? Like, we all have something, right? That just feels like Groundhog Day. It's like literally over and over again, we confront this. And it's not a matter of judging or blaming or trying to necessarily control that, but figuring out, how do we work within it? How do we build our capacity to work with it so that we can show up and be who we want to be, do the things in the world that we want to do? So I love that way of thinking about it.
It's a great language call out too, Neil, because I never talk about working under stress or under pressure. It's always about working in situations of stress and pressure. And because that is the situation. And the way I tend to see it, or my purpose, is to change the world's relationship with suffering, because it's not the suffering itself per se, particularly the internal experience of suffering. It's our relationship to the suffering. If we fuse with the suffering and operate from that place, then inevitably we try to avoid it. We try to make it go away. We spend enormous amounts of time, money, energy, resource in getting rid of it. But actually, if we can sit with it and recognize that this is showing up, this is the circumstance, and learn to sit with it, then that is the ongoing practice. And what's really interesting is that this evidence base now validates millennia-old techniques like mindfulness and acceptance practices, and how do we create space between us and our thoughts and our feelings and our sensations, and how can we then translate that into a daily practice, which is part of the reason why I fell in love with the evidence base, because I'd been interested in science forever, but also the marrying of mindfulness and meditation practices, which I'd always been fascinated by, acceptance practices and all these things that seem to be recurring patterns in the world's religions, philosophies, and recognizing that, but then having it in a great tool base is really, I love that part of it, because then it's not the Toby Jenkins framework for success. It's the hard science. It's worked in clinical settings around the world, and I get to apply it then in wellbeing and performance settings. And that's a gift.
Yeah. What made me think of this is, instead of being fully absorbed in your experience, you pop out and you're more the observer of it. You aren't it. Just like what you articulated, it's not, I'm working under stress or pressure. I'm working in an environment with stress and pressure. There's a distinction. There's a separation here.
Yeah. And that's literally, again, the science calls it fusing with that experience, but then the technique then becomes defusion. So how do I create that space or create that separation between me and my experience so then I can lift my head up enough to recognize that I have a choice of response here? And that's where mindfulness practices are really important, to be able to recognize thoughts as thoughts, feelings as feelings, sensations as sensations. It's where acceptance practices, and if we get good at this stuff and competent with it, we can plan for your anxiety, my imposter syndrome to show up, know that it's coming, know that it, in fact, is serving us in lots of ways because it, I don't know about your anxiety, but my imposter syndrome absolutely energizes me before I get into a room. I know that if I've had a terrible night's sleep with the kids, and I have a 9, 7, and a 3-year-old, if I've had a terrible night's sleep, it doesn't matter. The next day, I know I'll be fine because I'll be feeling afraid of making a goose of myself or being a good name. The imposter shows up and energizes me.
Yeah.
And so to work with that experience and almost to embrace that experience. And one of the things I have recognized, even it was only in the tail end of last year, but if we could apply gratitude to that experience to truly embrace our own tough stuff, that's where I see gratitude for the things around me I'm reasonably good at and the people around me. I've practiced that for a long time, but how do I turn gratitude on that internal experience showing up is a different ballgame.
Next level.
Yeah, and I think that's almost the opportunity of the practice, you know.
Yeah. I know. Since we talked, I've actually decided to rename my anxiety, and I've called it excited determination, because I really do think that's what it is, right? When I get in, like, I'm talking with somebody and I'm like noticing, like, I have even a little bit of anxiety when I get on a podcast or whatever. I have anxiety before I get on a coaching call. And I now just decide, no, this is just my excited determination that I really want to serve this person in front of me. It's really important to me that I show up and I perform at a level that's going to be in service and in help of this person. So I've just
You make a really good point there, Neil, which is if we think about it, we don't typically feel anxiety, frustration, imposter syndrome, anger, resentment, any of the so-called tough emotional experiences. We don't feel those things when we're about to put bread in the toaster.
No.
But for the parents listening to this podcast or the entrepreneurs who really care about the work that they're doing, and I think about my Olympic experience, the time when the tough experiences show up is when it's not a sign that we're weak or broken or inadequate or that something is missing. It is because we care.
Oh, and that's so good.
We care.
Yeah.
But the more we care, the more likely it is to show up. I mean, there's a reason why the day I arrived in the Olympic Village, I thought I had a stomach infection and it stopped the day I left. And if someone had said to me, Toby, this is a normal stress response. Mate, you're okay. Eat, drink, train normally. It'll just work its way through. Like, this is just part of being at this event that you've worked your entire life for. Then maybe we need to normalize that, right?
Yeah.
So the more we care, the more likely it is to show up, the more we can plan for it, the more we can expect it, the more we can learn to sit with it, which means all of those training moments are really about developing our competence to work with excited determination. I call mine Mara from a story in Buddhism where Mara is the demon of everything awful. And it, I mean, even in these ancient traditions, right, the reason I chose Mara was there's this story where Buddha and Mara have a cosmic battle and Buddha, an enlightened being, sort of walks away unscathed and Mara slinks off into the cosmos. Then a little while later, there's a knock at the door. Some of you listeners may have heard this, but there's a knock at the door. Buddha goes to the door, opens the door, and there's Mara standing there. And Buddha says to Mara, please come in, and treats Mara as a revered house guest and says, come in, and yeah, serves tea to Mara first. Sit at the table, they go through the tea ceremony, and then eventually Mara walks away. And I'd heard a little bit about sort of this idea of inviting your tough stuff into tea. Then what showed up, though, when I dug a bit deeper into that story was that Mara, that doesn't happen just once. Mara keeps on knocking in the entirety of Buddha's life, and Buddha keeps going to open the door and invites Mara in each time. And the key for me is that, or the light bulb for me from that understanding was, this is a never-ending practice. So how do you sit with excited determination? How do I sit with Mara showing up before a presentation or a client kickoff or what have you as well. I find the same with particularly new clients, right? Where I'm thinking, oh man, is this going to work? How's this going to go? They listen to me. They seem to have an amazing, you know, resume, whatever it might be.
Right.
Yeah. So the ongoing practice of all of these things is, and the competence in your practice is the key to it.
I love that. I love the way that we've framed this up and talked about flexible psychology and all that. So I'm wondering if you could talk to me about the three components that we talked about. Like, you took me through this exact practice about a month ago.
Yep.
Maybe it's 2 months ago. I don't know. But there was three pieces to this.
Yeah.
And so could you walk us through that?
Yeah. So for those listening, if you bring to mind a triangle and imagine at the bottom left of that triangle, the words open up. At the top of the triangle, there's be present. And at the bottom right of that triangle is do what matters. So that's open up, bottom left on the triangle, be present at the top, and do what matters on the bottom right. These are the three pillars of psychological flexibility. It's called the ACT Triflex. And ACT is acceptance and commitment therapy. If you're a psychologist, which is not me, I don't operate in clinical settings. It's acceptance and commitment training if you're a coach like me or you, Neil. And open up is not necessarily about opening up to others, but opening up to ourselves. Be present is very much around mindfulness. And do what matters is understanding things like purpose and values and the direction you're headed and who really matters to you. And so that core triangle, open up, be present, do what matters, that is the core of the never-ending practice of developing, maintaining, and improving psychological flexibility.
Yeah. I love that. So I'm wondering if we can walk through the exercise that you took me through that was like questions associated with all three of these. And then like, there's a couple of things you pointed out to me that were like, oh my gosh. So I just want to point those out as we go through. So at this point, everybody who's listening, what you might do, I mean, if you're driving or whatever, totally fine, just listen to this as we go through. But if you want to go through and actually do this exercise, which I think is really, really powerful, and I'm super grateful to Toby to share it with us on the show, is that you might come back to this during some time where you can journal. Because the only way this actually works is for you to do the practice, to answer these questions. So this is a great way to use your journaling time if you're doing that.
Okay, so I've titled this exercise the Momentum Exercise, and it encompasses the psychological flexibility. Before we start there, I love bringing a Stoic reflection in, and I know you and I spoke about this in the episode. And what I do is I ask people to do this in their phone. And I know a lot of people love writing, but there's a couple of reasons for putting it in your phone. One is that it's as private as it can be to you, particularly if you're doing this in an area with other people, because some of the things that show up, you might not be comfortable sharing. The second is it's editable. So my suggestion to you would be don't take more than 30 seconds in your answer. Give yourself a constraint, a positive constraint on your answering time, because we're trying to get your gut responses here. Mm. And from what I've learned about working with entrepreneurs, founders, elite athletes, elite military executives, is that typically everything after 30 seconds is wordsmithing and perfectionism that kicks in. So what we want to do is really constrain it. And that editability is really important. And of course, then once we get you from zero to one and on a draft of what this looks like for you, then having your phone nearby means that you can update at any time. Inevitably, if you're anything like me, then the phone is way too close far too often in the day, but let's use that for good and keep a note in the phone where you capture these things and then reflect and use them as an ongoing practice. So that would be my counsel here. So if you have your phone, use that. If you really want to use a notepad, that's okay too. But there's something about the permanence of a notepad that makes it hard, that it appears that you have to get it right. Whereas what we're looking for is pure editability. And yeah, so you can adapt it as you seem to adapt your practice as well.
Thank you for framing up that way. So I think it's really important that everyone realizes like what we're trying to do is get what Toby said, the gut response. So he actually did set a timer and he told me, stop writing. When he took me through this, which was great because I tend to be a very wordy person, so I'm just going to keep writing as long as I can, right? So I think setting that timer for 30 seconds, really, really important part of this to get really amazing answers to these questions.
Okay. So the first header then, if you open up a new note in your phone, title it Momentum, and I can send all of these questions are available to download from my website as well, Neil. So if anyone wants to get it, we can share a link to that for the Momentum resource, which will take you through. There's some links to the science, there's the questions themselves, so you can use it or revisit it or share it with anyone else if anyone wants to share it. I mean, the beauty of this is it's not my IP. This is 40 years of evidence-based open source science, so happy days. So Momentum note, title it that, new header then in your notes, title that Commitments. And this is the Stoic reflection where the Stoics would say, and many other philosophies and traditions would say, contemplate death to appreciate life. Mm-hmm. And so if you open up your calculator then, I'd love you to put in this calculation, which is 80 minus your age equals what? Then multiply that by 365. So 80 minus your age equals, then multiply that answer by 365. And these are, statistically speaking, your days left to live. Varies from community to community, obviously, and probably the more privileged end of communities, frankly, if your life expectancy is 80. But these are the days left to live. And it's less about the number and much more about making concrete the fact that time is finite. So whatever number that is for you, how are you going to choose to spend those days? Put that into your note, days left to live, and hit pause any time in this recording if you want to just take notes, but I'll keep rolling through for the sake of time. The second number then, open up the calculator again, is your age multiplied by 365, and these are the days you've been alive. So your age multiplied by 365 equals what? And these are the days you've been alive. The reasons for these two questions, the first is, when my father died, he was 66. His parents had been 98 and 93 respectively. There was this huge expectation, certainly from me, that he was only two-thirds of the way there. And that was a massive check in the mirror for me. What am I doing? Why am I doing? What if I'm already two-thirds of the way there? And in which case, I better get some clarity. And I think that was a big part of what really set me adrift at the time. The second number then was when I resigned from another company that I'd started to try to develop a app around this science base. A mate of mine said, hey, how's Toby 2.0 going? So through numbers of companies, resigned from two of the most important ones in my opinion and from my own companies. And he said, how's 2.0 going? And I said, mate, it's not, surely this can't be 2.0. And really this number of the days you've been alive is about recognizing that you've been through thousands of days of change. Mm-hmm. You've done this before. We all have. And if this is a versioning, what we're trying to do then in a change process, particularly into uncertainty or in a reinvention process, is to recognize that today I make a choice, tomorrow I can make a new choice. I've done this before, I can do this again, and in fact, I can continue to do it. It's an ongoing process. So to recognize that and that number is super important. So they're the two numbers in your commitment header. So days left to live and days of alive. Then next header is open up. And in open up, I'd love you to consider what's a challenging situation you have at the moment, either a recent one or one that's immediately coming up, because the micro often reflects the macro in these experiences. So what shows up in one setting often shows up across many settings. The questions here then are, what are the thoughts that show up when you think about this situation? What are the thoughts that show up? What are you saying to yourself? The second question is, what emotions show up for you when you think about this particularly challenging situation? And the third is, what are the sensations that show up for you? And in the very act of writing them down into your phone, you are practicing the first technique, which is defusion. So by writing down, this is where journaling comes in, Neil, as you alluded to earlier, writing down your thoughts, your feelings, your sensations, you are creating space between your internal experience and the choices you want to make from here. So you've just practiced technique number one.
And that's called diffusion.
Defusion, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's that creation of space. Then the second technique is very much around acceptance. And one of those acceptance techniques is labeling. So you have your excited determination. I have my Mara. I've had many names, but it's about identifying what this experience feels and looks like for you is this next section. So I'll ask you a bunch of questions here. When you think about this experience, so those thoughts, feelings, and sensations, where in your body or around your body do you feel them? Do they have a color? Do they have a size? Do they have a shape? Do they have a texture? And when you think about that experience, having answered all of those questions, can you give it a name? And as I alluded to earlier, this is about having named mine Mara. This is about recognizing when Mara shows up, to be able to open the door and invite Mara in and practice gratitude for Mara showing up. By far, open up, in my experience with clients, is the hardest part of the triangle, because we have been taught that these things are bad. This experience is bad. And yet it is the one thing that we all experience in varying shapes, sizes. I've had clients call theirs wrecking ball because it's a shiny black ball that sits in their tummy. It might be blob that wraps around the neck and feels like they're getting choked. I've had people call them Trent, Reg. Everyone has this experience, or people typically identify it reasonably quickly, but come up with a name, and then the practice becomes welcome back, Mara, or welcome back, excited determination. Thank you. It's great to see you again. Sometimes it
so
doesn't.
So glad you're here with me today.
Yeah, you're back again. Thank you. So it can be tough going, but that is the practice, is recognizing it and then welcoming it in, recognizing that it's part of you. It's probably a part of what's driven you to wherever you are today. And then how am I going to choose to respond when this shows up? So that's the open up part. Be present. Be present is a new header then in your note. And it's very much around mindfulness practice. And mindfulness often has this stigma, I guess, attached to it, that it's sitting in a corner with a cushion and a candle saying om to the universe. But in fact, mindfulness is not that. It's about recognizing thoughts as thoughts, feelings as feelings, sensations as sensations. It's being present and connected to the present moment. And the way to connect to the present moment is through our senses often, whether that's sight, sound, taste, touch, smell. I'll give you an example of how I practice mindfulness and perhaps adapt it for yourself. But if you think about one thing that you do every day, and how can you then be more present in that moment? And this is the beginnings of starting your bar so low with a mindfulness practice that you can't fail. For me, that's a coffee. If I am not mindful with a coffee, I get to the bottom of the cup and it's gone. Where did it go? I was really looking forward to that coffee. But if I'm mindful with it, I hold the cup. I notice the texture. I notice the sensation, the temperature against the palm of my hands. I can smell it. I taste it. I can see the steam rising off it. I can hear the coffee being prepared. And so it doesn't take more time. It's being present in the moment, which I think particularly for a busy entrepreneurial, a founder or entrepreneur, it's not about doing something different or adding another routine to your day. It's about integrating it into what you are already doing.
Yeah.
And particularly for entrepreneurs and founders, I find, and busy people generally, that is the key. So don't allocate more time on your diary. I already know that your diary is horrendous. Just be present for the moment that you are definitely there each day.
And I will not approach my coffee in the same way ever again. Now that you described that to me, I'm like, I have that same experience. And I love my morning coffee. It's just such a ritual for me, but I haven't thought about applying a mindfulness practice to it. So thank you for that little go.
Yeah, pleasure. Well, it's Atomic Habits 101, right? Anchor it in something that you already do.
Yeah.
That you already enjoy, and then enjoy it more. I mean, really, it's not so much about doing mindfulness, but being mindful. So how can you be there to truly enjoy your coffee? And I inevitably get it wrong all the time, Bill. I'm definitely not mindful all the time.
Yeah, I don't think any of us are. But like you're saying, it's integrating that into what you're already doing just so you can have a fuller, more rich experience of whatever your day-to-day is.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love
that. And literally every moment is an invitation to be mindful. So if you ever think of it, be mindful. Notice the sensation of the chair against the back of your legs. I mean, we've been sitting down for this whole time. I haven't noticed it, but now I just did.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, oh, yeah.
There it is.
Yep.
Yeah, it's all there. It's all available to us. So
right. How
can we choose to practice it? The second mindfulness practice that I love is my favorite question, probably to me, the most powerful one, which is, what if this is the last time? So what if this is the last time? And what I find with that question is, if I'm saying goodnight to my daughters, if I'm thinking about this podcast, what if this is the last time I get to share the story, the things that I really care about, this technique with people? But what if it is that I want to give? It's not just about connecting to the present, but there's something about that question that also dials in, who do I want to be in this moment?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that brings out my values with love, gratitude, humility, exploration, contribution. How can I bring those to this moment? And so that single question, if you need one, I have found is probably the most powerful mindfulness tool to come back to the present. And particularly as a parent, I find myself using it when things are getting challenging with the kids. But yeah, when Mara shows up, well, what if this is the last time? Then I'd find it instantly grounding.
I know you shared that with me and when you took me through this exercise, and I have used it since then. I agree with you. It literally drops me into just being right here, right now. And so thank you for sharing that. That was one of the things I was hoping that you would say, because I think it's so powerful, so simple, right? But and so powerful.
It's probably my favorite out of it, all the mindfulness practices, and there are a bunch of others. But
so good. So yeah. Good.
And then the final section, then, if you create a new note in your header of do what matters. So we've done open up, we've got be present and those two techniques, and then do what matters. Do what matters. I'll run you through 6 questions here. Again, 30 seconds, please, people. Don't let yourself
your timers.
Yeah. Set your timers ready to go. So the questions are these. First question is, what are your values? Second question is, who is important to you? And I often hit pause on this question, and I asked you, Neil, right?
Yes, I failed. So everybody knows.
Your own name on the list. Yeah.
Right.
It was important. It was to not. Individuals or groups of people you ever
did. Which was fascinating, really fascinating to me.
And as an exercise in self-awareness, it's recognizing that without you, there is no relationship to anyone or anything else. And so how do we put our own name back on the important list? And often I find that with the people who are really trying to make major shifts or exit a business, say, as a founder, which is a common transition point that I work with, if they're exiting, a lot of it is about taking their own name, or even if they're not exiting, but they're trying to figure out whether they stay or go or what have you, it's putting their own name on the list and recognizing that the business is in service of them rather than them have it be the only place their names is on the org chart. And so they're absolutely chained to the business that they've created because they love it often and they're driven by it and they get a sense of fulfillment from it, all those great things. But to invert that relationship to be, well, how can this business serve me? Who am I? As separated from the business, and to decouple that identity a bit.
Yeah.
But please put your own name on the list. From a well-being, leadership, performance standpoint, super important.
Yeah. And I think to your point, so, so important for everybody to be inverting that relationship, like Toby just said, thinking about the business that is serving me.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter if there's no you, there's no business. So
absolutely.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. And we've articulated really specifically that time is finite already.
Yes.
So how are you going to choose? What choices are you going to make in the remaining days that you have? And how are you going to spend it? And who else on that list are you going to spend your time with? Because how many of those people are getting the time that you would like to spend with them? A super common problem too for entrepreneurs is, well, how are your relationships with the people who you say are most important to you? Tell me about that. Show me your diary. How does that align?
Yes.
The remaining questions, just to give people that. So what are your values? Who is important to you? The next question is, what is important to you? So that might be goals, ideas, concepts, causes that you really care about. Fourth question then is, what is your purpose? Often a challenging one. Once again, just take your 30 seconds and see what shows up. Grab the word or two and stick it down, because a draft, 0 to 1, a draft, even a terrible one, is infinitely more valuable than nothing. And for the mathematicians, it is. So get a draft and then use the ongoing process of life and business to test that and see whether this can drive or direct your decision-making. Then question number 5 is, what would you willingly do for free? Question number 6 is, what energizes you? So those questions again, what are your values? Who is important to you? What is important to you? What is your purpose? What would you willingly do for free? And what energizes you? And it's less about getting perfect answers and more about recognizing what are the themes that show up across those initially. And over time, yes, definitely reflect, refine, iterate, go one to infinity on the core of who you are. Because a lot of, to me, what this becomes is it's about internalizing a framework, an internalized criteria set for how you want to respond in face of uncertainty, complexity, challenge, the inevitable curveballs of life, whether that's in business or health or relationships or whatever. The only place, if you can develop that internal criteria set and that internal framework, then in a storm around you, you can come back to your own internal anchor rather than anchoring on a trophy cabinet and trying to win yet another award or whatever it might be, where you have no control of those outcomes, but you can control and you have a say in the choices you make.
So
just to recap those three areas in the triangle, then we've got open up, which is we practice the diffusion, we practice the acceptance of the labeling. So writing things down, got two techniques there. Then be present. We had the, what is the one thing you do every day? How can you be mindful in that moment? And then what if this is the last time? And then the do what matters part, we ran through those questions as the beginnings of articulating some degree of definition of what truly matters to you. No one else, not your friends, not your family, not your partner, not your society, not your business, not your colleagues, but what matters to you? And then how can you drive decision-making from that point? And yeah, to me, it's about also then recognizing that there's a direct correlation between the more you care in the bottom right and do what matters, the more you care about that stuff, then the more likely you will need to open up your tough internal experience. And what's interesting though is, final analogy for you is, if I was to smash broken glass and say, hey, Neil, you're wherever you're listening, smash broken glass on the floor, shoes off, let's do some motivational walking. Yeah, the immediate response is, Toby, you're bonkers. But if I change one condition, which is bring to mind the people or person most important to you in the world, they're in distress, they need your help, are you willing to walk across the broken glass? And you're nodding. I see that in audiences all over the world. People nod and say, oh, yes. And what happens in that moment is that it shows us we're terrible at pointless pain. No one wants to walk across broken glass needlessly. But if we can get clear on what truly matters to us, humans are extraordinary in their ability to not just endure suffering, but embrace it in service of what truly matters. And also in that moment, the pain doesn't change. The glass doesn't change. Your feet doesn't change. The expectation of what you're going to have to go through doesn't change. What changes is your relationship to it. Suddenly it is worthwhile for you to walk across this glass. And in some respects, that captures this idea of opening up, being present enough to recognize the choice, knowing what matters in advance. So then if you see that on the other side of the broken glass, you're going to step into this. And that is an extraordinary thing about humans, I think. It inspires me every day that a person perhaps sitting next to me on the bus has got up and is walking. I have no idea what battle they're facing, but the certainty is that they have one. And yet they have still chosen to get up and try to move forward. That to me is unbelievable, inspiring.
I agree. I think it's one of the main reasons why I became a coach is just the humans. Like, we're incredible and there's so much that people go through and yet they persevere and they achieve amazing things. And I just think the human spirit, I think, is really what motivates me to keep doing stuff and trying to help people and be inspired by the clients that because I have amazing clients as well. I mean, every week there's some challenge, right? Like I just don't think that there is a human who leaves this planet unscathed and creates an amazing life experience for yourself in the same. And sometimes it's not just in spite of, but it's because of. I mean, that's what is so cool about getting to be a coach, right? Is witnessing that. Like, it's beyond. I just feel like it's one of the pivotal experiences, at least for me.
I had a client and we went through that exercise in our first session together, and specifically about running. She hadn't run for 17 years, and she's run her own businesses and all sorts of stuff, but she said, I used to run all the time, but I'm terrified. We ran through that exercise, and turns out her fear point was like an oblong, a blue oblong that sat on her chest. Mm-hmm. Was her experience of fear, and to recognize, and we broke down, okay, I want to run. Why do you want to run? What is the long-term benefit of that? The short-term benefit of not running was avoiding this oblong of pain that she was experiencing and fear. That's the short-term benefit. So it's actually logical that we avoid this stuff.
Totally, yeah.
But the long-term cost of that is she doesn't get to run with the people she loves. This is an old passion that she's completely disconnected from. And then to recognize the long-term benefit, the short-term pain of moving towards what truly matters to us is we have to sit with that experience of fear or frustration or anxiety or what have you. But then the long-term benefit of that is she gets to be the role model she wants to be as a mum. She gets to run with the people she loves. She gets to be outside. She gets to reconnect. And then we broke it right down. I said, what's a run? And she said, oh, it'd be 30 minutes. And I was like, no, it's not. Running is not that it doesn't require 30 minutes. What's the shortest run you could do that would constitute a run? And then in the end, she decided there was this tree just outside her, you know, down the footpath from the, she ran 200 meters and ran home and sent me a selfie and said, oh my God, that's like 17 years I haven't run.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. And so exactly to your point, I mean, if we can articulate what's holding us back or the experience of it and change our relationship to it, it's not that the oblong didn't show up. It's still there.
Yeah.
And it's going to take practice and developing and changing the relationship with that. But it's possible.
So amazing. It reminds me of that quote that, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember exactly who said it or what exactly they said, but something to the effect of everything that we want and who we want to become is on the other side of fear, right? Like we have to go through it to get to whatever it is that we want.
Another framing for that, Neil, that I love, that a different client of mine, he called his sloth was hit, and it was the texture of it. It was gray. It was a blanket. Super high performing exec starting his own business, but really trying to work on his health as well. He found a sloth figurine in the post office and he bought it. And he was like, Toby, look what I've found. And that figurine he carries with him. He brings sloth to training with him.
Oh my gosh.
And so rather than even going through fear, I think the invitation really is to say, how do I bring it with me? And again, you change the relationship to, I must break through this oblong that's sitting on my chest, because it's not the enemy. It's how do I run with the oblong, or how do I bring sloth to the gym in those instances, physical, or how do I sit with the pyramid of pain whilst I'm having a difficult conversation with my brother, who is the chairman of the business that I'm the CEO of, and I need to figure out how I'm going to tell him that I need to exit. And I think this is one of the things that I've learned, is that it's not about breaking the fear or removing it or fighting it or having it as the enemy. It's about bringing it with you. And I think that can sometimes help people, because otherwise you articulate these experiences and feel like, okay, now I must get rid of the oblong. But we're just back at where we are.
Yeah. And I think that creates a lot of tension. I think if we're spending energy and attention trying to get rid of that thing, then I can see a lot of truth and how that would really be like a wasted, when we can really just figure out, okay, excited determination is going to be part of my experience. Like, it's just coming with me. Like, 30 years have told me that it's just going to be with me, right? Like,
absolutely. It's not going
right?
It's so old. Yeah.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So how do I just bring it with me and use it? So good. Oh my gosh, this was such a powerful conversation. I just, number one, want to thank you so much for bringing all your wisdom and all your insight, and thank you for doing the work that you do. And then if somebody wants to reach out and figure out how they can, you know, do some more work with you, I know we have all of your links, and we'll for sure link up to the freebie that you have on your website that has all of these questions that someone, if you didn't write them down as we're going through the podcast, we'll link that up. But what does it look like to work with you? What would be like, how do they get your help?
Yeah, my website is Logical Starting Points, or LinkedIn, or I'm on Instagram and post some stuff there as well. The toolkit is the open source science that I have sort of gathered in one place. So download it. So yes, it's got these questions, but it also has a bunch of other tools that can help with
An
initial assessment. So it's called the Valued Living Questionnaire. There's another one called the Choice Point, which is all around deconstructing really specific choices put together by a number of psychologists, doctors. So I've kind of gathered a few of these things into a single spot as a resource for people if they want to tap that. I mean, reach out. I have one-to-one coaching clients and I'm running workshops. They're the two things I'm doing at the moment. Around the workshop is very similar to what we've just gone through in terms of the core of how do you develop psychological flexibility for teams and organizations. And the one-to-one program is a minimum 12-month engagement to really help people trying to make those major shifts. Yeah, in that instance, it's a kickoff and then fortnightly coaching and access anytime is the idea, and for the 20 clients that I have at any given time. So I tend to limit myself on that in order to really serve the people who are committing to those one-on-one processes.
Yeah.
And then use the workshops as ways of education, training, development for people who are trying to, you know, bring teams up to speed or organizations up to speed on this stuff too. And I write a fair bit too, obviously, and love that process. So I write about these topics and related. So a few different ways. And thank you so much for having me, Neil.
Yeah.
This is conversation number three, I think, for us.
I think it's number three.
I love everyone. Yeah.
It's so fun. But I just noticed like there's a lot of alignment between the two of us. And I love the work that you're doing. And I just can really relate, number one, with your athlete background, because even though I was an Olympian, I definitely was an athlete my whole life. And so anyways, I just really love the work that you're doing. And it's so powerful. I mean, literally just doing that exercise really helped me frame up, okay, what do I want my business to look like going forward? What do I want 2024 to be? But beyond that, just like, what is my purpose, right? Just even that question, like, you know, even coming up with an answer to that was really, really powerful. So thank you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I always feel like this work is a privilege, you know, and I know you do too with yours. So it's cool to share that as well. People are extraordinary. And so hopefully some of your audience have got some value from today.
100%. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Success Genius. I truly hope you found the content valuable and inspiring. My mission with Success Genius is to provide you, the ambitious entrepreneur, with the tools, strategies, and mindsets necessary for achieving success in a healthy and sustainable way. I'm dedicated to helping you balance your entrepreneurial aspirations with a vibrant and fulfilling life and lifestyle. If you found value in today's episode, here's how you can support this mission. Subscribe to Success Genius. By subscribing, you'll have all of our latest episodes and insights right at your fingertips. Leave us a rating and review. Your feedback is invaluable to us. It helps us improve and it helps fellow entrepreneurs find our show. Let's grow this community of success geniuses together. And share the episode with a friend, colleague, or loved one. If you think today's episode could help someone you know, please don't hesitate to share it. The ripple effect of knowledge can have a powerful impact. As we conclude this episode, remember that as entrepreneurs, we're all on this journey together. Supporting each other's growth and well-being is one of the most significant ways we can achieve greatness. I know how very valuable your time and attention is, so I want to thank you for spending some of it today with me and this show. Together, we can spread the message of healthy success to our kids, our friends, our neighbors, and our communities. Thank you for being a part of this. I couldn't do it without you.